All right, today we're going to focus on the Anshei Knesset Hagadola, or the Great Assembly. It really translates as the men of the Great Assembly, but I figure I'll just translate it as the Great Assembly so it doesn't seem so sexist, but it is. So, but it's not really. I mean, it is the men of the Great Assembly. They all had wives. So we'll assume that their wives had quite a bit of influence through their husbands in this process. So where did Rabbi Wasserman leave you off, just so I know? Just give me like one sentence or two. Where are you holding in history right now? Okay, I got it. So we're going to do a speck of a sweep here. So basically what happened is Torah is given, come into the land of Israel, dray around a little bit, build the first temple, have the first commonwealth, right? Fabulous. First temple's there, lots of miracles, Israel's strong. King, right? Everything's going very nicely. And then Babylonian exile. Okay, so Babylonians come in and they exile the Jews. This is the first of the exiles. The Egyptian exile doesn't count as one of the exiles. We have a tradition of four major exiles. We're in the fourth right now. So the first one is the Babylonian exile. The first one leads right into the second one, which is the Persian Mede exile. So you've got the first temple. The first temple is destroyed by the Babylonians. The Babylonians have a method of conquer. So they were the major empire at the time, and their method of conquer was move in and exile the people of the land. So it wasn't just directed at the Jews, but the way that they conquered territory and stabilized their leadership was by removing the inhabitants from their land to another land so that there wouldn't be people of the land who were defending their land. They severed the connection between people and land so that there would be less of a chance of insurrection.
Is it also to hopefully assimilate the people into their
land? Yes. 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 So at this time, and this is where one place where America really differs from the entire sweep of history, but in Americans' quest to separate church and state and the leadership of church and state, it's because of all of this. So what the Babylonians did was they didn't have a state religion that was theirs alone, but what they did was religion and state were mixed. So they had pagan religions, but it was mixed in with the state and the leadership, as was early Christianity and even middle Christianity, and now not so much later Christianity, but it's a different topic. But meanwhile, what they did was they'd come in, move the people out, and then try to blend as much as they could, blend populations, blend religion. So they weren't about, it wasn't important to them that you leave behind your religion as much as you should open up to all religions, incorporate it all in. So that's a problem for the Jews because we're very exclusive, which can make us seem stuck up too, which is one reason why people didn't like us so much, because we weren't into being open to all religions. We had ours, and ours is good, and we have boundaries, and on the other side of those boundaries, we don't believe in that, and we cut it off. And so this did not fit in with the political milieu of the time of just being open to everything. So even if there were themes in certain places, you could conquer and integrate rather than be exclusive. So, the Jews are, the land is taken over, temple destroyed, Jews kicked off, off to Babylon they go. They're in Babylon. Babylonia is slowly taken over by the Persian Medes. The Jews are still out, but that's where the Purim story comes in. So first Jewish exile moves right into second Jewish exile, Persian Mede exile. The Persian Mede exile is different in that the Persians do want to kill us. Right, so the Babylonians weren't after our bodies, they were just after our equanimity. But the Persians were after our bodies. They wanted to kill us. Okay? So we have about a 70-year exile, which is floats from one end to the next. And after that, Queen Esther's son, Darius, this is the general, I mean, there's lots of different flows of history. As you know, history can be told from different points of view, and so there's different things, but I'm just giving you one version just so you know that it's one, and there are other versions and other stories along the way, but this is the easy version here, one strand, that Queen Esther's son, by Ahasuerus, so he's Jewish, but of a non-Jewish father, Darius, he allows the Jews to return and rebuild the temple. So that in the Purim story, which you'll hear next week, when the king says to Esther, "What do you want, Esther, my darling? Until half the kingdom I'll give you. half the kingdom, the middle point of the kingdom, was Jerusalem. So what he was telling her is, ask for anything you want except for the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Don't ask for that. Until half the kingdom I'll give you, but not more than that. So, but Darius was able to give the Jews that. So they were allowed to go back. They weren't allowed to be totally in control. They still were a vassal state of the Persians, but they were permitted to return to the land and build their temple again, go back to their worship. So that's where we are. That's the beginning of today. So that's the history. So what happened, though, during that time? A little more background information. So we see this sweep. Is that pretty clear so far? Destruction of the Second Temple, Babylonian exile, moves into the Persian Medes, take over. Persians are in charge now. Purim story, now return to the land. Meanwhile, 70 years where the Jews were not in the land, did not have the temple, and did not have the Sanhedrin, the ruling body of 70 sages that were the legislative body of the Jews at the time. So they didn't have that set up. So a few things had to be set up along the way. So the Babylonian kingdom, which was actually the Babylonian Jewish community, was actually set up a little bit before that first exile. So we're talking a 70-year time span of exile, but probably 15, 20 years before that major exile, there is some prophetic understanding that things might go this way. And so some of the sages go off to Babylon and set up yeshivas, shuls, mikvahs, so that when the Jews get there, there's infrastructure. Right? So the infrastructure is there. So we see the beginning of the exile, you have that psalm by the rivers of Babylon where the Jews are crying how terrible it is. We're being taken out by the rivers of Babylon. We lay down and wept. They asked us to sing our beautiful songs. The Jews were known for the lovely songs that they sang in the Beit HaMikdash. And the Babylonians said to them, sing your gorgeous songs. We love that. And they said, how could we sing those songs in exile? It's not possible. These are songs of religious communion with our God in our space. You're taking us out of our space? Can't happen. So the tremendous tears, and we recall that at every chuppah, when we say, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, forget my right hand, that's that psalm, and that was the sentiment as the Jews left. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, forget my right hand, like the, my strength is in Jerusalem, and they're being taken into Babylon. So there's that heavy leaving of the land of Israel, but shortly thereafter, it turns into America. Everybody's totally comfortable. You got your schools, you got your shuls, you got your mikvahs, you got your federation. Everybody's happy. Are we crying today that we don't have a holy land? We're not. We're so comfortable with all our institutions, and that's what it was in Babylon. Very shortly thereafter, 30, 40 years, the Jews are comfortable, wealthy, hanging out, no problem, and that's how the Purim story happened. The Purim story happened by the, if you remember the writing on the wall, you've probably heard that expression before. You know where that comes from? He saw the writing on the wall. The handwriting on the wall, right? You've all heard that expression. It comes from, I think, the prophet Daniel, I'm not positive. It comes from a biblical prophet where the king of Persia knew that it was going to be a 70-year exile. He counted 70 years from the beginning of the exile, saw 70 as passing with no hope of the Jews returning, celebrated and said, ha-ha, they're not returning. They're mine now, the kingdom's mine. I don't have to worry about the return of the Jews. Meanwhile, so he makes the party, the Purim party, which we'll talk about in just a second. But meanwhile, before that, there's some writing on the wall, mysterious writing on the wall, I think in blood, right? And it says, you know, king will be destroyed or something. But he sees king is not destroyed. 70 years passes, king not destroyed, time for a party. So he makes the Purim party in which he invites everybody in the kingdom. He even has kosher wine and kosher food so the Jews can celebrate too. And the Jews do. They go to the party and celebrate. But what are they celebrating? The fact that the Jews aren't returning. So the Jews are at the king's party celebrating the king not having to return the Jews. They're celebrating their own downfall and the fact their prophets don't count anymore. So that's the opening up of the Purim story. The party that they open up with is the party of celebration that the exile is not coming to an end. And the Jews are okay with it. They all go to the party. No problem. And even the midrashes, the midrashic commentaries say that the lovely dishes that were used to serve at that party were the dishes, all the utensils from the Beit HaMikdash. Then when they destroyed the first temple, they took all the Kohanic vessels, the gold and the silver and the beautiful things that were there, the things for sacrifices and whatever they had, took them all, brought them to Persia, and now they bring them out for the party. So the smorgasbord is laid with kosher food in the temple dishes. And the Jews are eating from them, saying, we don't care that the temple's been destroyed. Now these dishes are just pretty. They're not ceremonial anymore. It's not about our disconnect from the Holy. Babylon's good. We're set up. So the truth is, Babylon was set up then for a 2,500-year history. Only in 1952 was it the end of the Jewish life in Babylon, in Iraq. So until 1952, from before the destruction of the first temple, until 1952, so it was really a reaction to the establishment of the third commonwealth, the state of Israel, today, right, in 1948, that in 1952 the Jews were kicked out. But after 2,500 years of continuous Jewish life in Babylon, and it came from this destruction of the first temple. So we have the Jewish community established in Babylon. So just keep that in mind. Strong Jewish community, which continued until 1952. Very comfortable community, just like America today. Very comfortable. People didn't feel like going back. So that's one thing that's set up during that time. The next thing that happens during that time is that because of the fact that the Babylonians go in, conquer, and then mix up populations, they were conquering Assyria too. They brought in some Assyrians into the land of Israel. So they kicked the Jews out of Israel, bring the Assyrians into Israel. One group of the Assyrians came from a city called Kuta. Kuta had residents called Kutim, or if you're one of those Shabbos people, instead of Shabbat people, they're the Kusim, right? So depending on how you pronounce that letter, right? So the Kusim move into the Shomron area. That's upper Israel, Galilee, etc. Their narrative, just to give them fair play, although I'm teaching you the Jewish narrative, their narrative is that they're from the tribes that lived there and that they stayed in Israel during the exile period. Our narrative is they were brought in from Assyria, foreigners who came into the land. Now, because of the whole accept everybody's religion thing, they came in with their religion, moved into Jewish territory. Even though the Jews were kicked out, it was still Jewish flavor in the air of philosophy in that piece of land. And so they were kind of open to Jewish thoughts, philosophy, traditions, customs. And I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but this is the story. They were attacked by lions a lot. So there was a sustained lion attack. And through this, they came to understand that the Jewish God, this is their story even, the Jewish God must not be happy with us that we are practicing other things too. Maybe if we're in this land, we should practice only Judaism. So they all convert to Judaism in their minds officially. Okay, so now they are practicing their version, pretty close, their version of Judaism, in the land, okay? Now, so they're there for these 70 years while we're gone. Now, time to come back, right? So you got those guys practicing here, you got the Jews happy there, and now you have permission to come back. So the sages say, great, come back, everybody! And they respond just like Americans do today. No, we're really comfortable here. We don't feel like going back with you. And so they don't. And so just a trickle of people go back to Israel. And that trickle of people, being the comfortable American Babylonians that they are intermarried already. They're intermarried, they're not educated, they're not Zionistic, they're not very into it. You've got a weak group coming back to the land to reestablish, led by some stronger people. So the stronger people take a look at their weak followers and think, oh my gosh, what the heck are we going to do with these guys? This pathetic troop, we have to really get them going. We've got to establish a stronger body than we've had in the past. In the past, we've had the Sanhedrin, 70 people that run the whole thing. Now we need to swell the ranks of the Sanhedrin. We're going to grow it to 120. We're going to call it the Great Assembly, and we're going to integrate into this Great Assembly the prophets and the wise people and the cream of the crop to lead the effort into establishing the Second Commonwealth. Okay, so that's how we get the Great Assembly.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there a remaining group that stayed in Jerusalem and stayed in Israel with the first exile? And didn't they establish some kind of a, not a Sanhedrin, but a school called the Palestinian school as opposed to the Babylonian school?
You're thinking about the second destruction when they established Yavna. That was the second destruction. Okay. Yes, there was a remnant left, but they did not have infrastructure. So they were pretty much wiped out. So there were individuals left there, maybe a couple of minions here and there. But there wasn't a community that had infrastructure and government that was left behind. That wasn't there. Really, the whole center moved to Babylonia, which is important to understand because as we see the political ramifications of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly, we'll see that there is this tension between the primacy of Babylon and the primacy of Israel. Which is the most important place? From which place does Torah emanate? So you've got the great yeshivas established in Babylon, and you have the little wayward, pathetic schools in Israel in the beginning.
In Israel.
Now, the reestablishment of the infrastructure, right? Because it was wiped out.
Yeah.
So now you do have individuals still there, but it was wiped out. So you have basically stragglers left behind. The Shomronim, the Samaritans, that's how you say Shomronim in English. So I'm sure you've all heard of the Good Samaritan. So we'll see there's a political thing going on with the Good Samaritan and the Samaritans that we're talking about. It's the same ones. But let's back up for a second and then you'll see how that fits in. So you have the Samaritans, the Shomronim, in Upper Israel, and they are claiming to be the Jews who are the Jews. We were here the whole time where you were gone. It's our land, our tradition, our everything, up to us. And it's interesting, the Talmud even says they kept mitzvahs better than the Jews. Their matzah was more kosher than the Jews. So you'd think that'd be a praise, right? Sounds good. Oh, look how frum they are. Like, look how religious, how exacting their standards are. All of their mitzvahs are kept to a high degree.
What do they have to do with the Assyrians?
They are the Assyrian tribe that was brought in. Right. Not all the Assyrians, but one city of Assyrians that were brought in that converted. So the Talmud talks about how good they were at keeping mitzvahs, which sounds like a praise initially, unless you understand that we have a tradition that the more you are commanded, the harder it is to do it. So we have this concept, greater is the one who's commanded than the one who's not commanded. So this is the whole philosophic concept that we won't go into right now, but I'll just give you the quick veneer of it. What's better, to give tzedakah because you're kind or give tzedakah because it's a mitzvah? So yes, because you're kind, but yes, because it's a mitzvah. So we would think our immediate reaction is because you're kind, right? You should become such a kind person, and of course you want to give tzedakah. But Jewish tradition says, no, it's better to give it because it's a mitzvah. So two different reasons, and there's more than two, but two different reasons. Reason number one is, as soon as you're commanded, a yetzer hara kicks in. As soon as you have the positive mitzvah, give tzedakah, you have inside you a rebellion that says, oh, you can't tell me what to do. I'm not giving tzedakah. I don't have to give tzedakah if I don't want to give tzedakah. And so you have this inner dialogue saying, give, don't give, give, don't give. Right? If you just want to give, there's no pulling you back. So that when you finally give, there's no triumph of the giving. It's just because you're kind. So you're just doing it because you're you. But once you have that mitzvah, that commandment, so then there's that struggle. I don't want to do it. Right? So that's number one. You are greater when you overcome your Yetzirah and give. But more than that, so that's reason number one that you're greater. But reason number two is, if you give tzedakah because you're you, then that's just an extension of you. Let's skip the dialogue concept for a minute and just figure you're not that nice. You're not that sharing, right? So how will you behave in a way that's greater than who you are? How will you go beyond yourself? Only because there's a system of commandments that says, extend, extend, extend. Be bigger than you. Tap into this system. This whole system of mitzvahs is bigger than you are. You'd never think to do half the things. Even things like, that aren't kindnesses, but putting on tefillin, would you ever consider it? Really? I mean, like, what is that? And yet, it has spiritual ramifications. So, if you want to be bigger than you, you tap into the commandments. The one who's commanded is greater than the one who's not because they're part of a greater system. They extend their reach thereby by moving into something greater. Right? So the fact, with that in mind, the fact that the Talmud recounts that the Shomronim, the Samaritans, were better at keeping the mitzvahs is our proof they weren't Jewish.
That they weren't.
Because the Jews have a hard time keeping mitzvahs. So if they kept them so nicely, they must not have been Jewish.
But that explains a lot.
Right? It does explain a lot. So I have to tell you a realization I came to on my trip to Israel as I read a book that somebody gave me. I just read Miriam's Kitchen, which won a National Book Award. It's a regular press book, but it's all about a woman's venture into kashrut and her relationship with kashrut, being raised in a socialist, atheistic Jewish family who kept kosher style, moving out of kosher style in her adult life, and then moving back into it as she marries in her 40s and has children and can't manage to give them tray food, but doesn't really want to keep a kosher kitchen, but there's no point in having kosher food without kosher dishes, and so just her whole like process and through her mother-in-law. And I realized as reading this and her whole inner dialogue and her relationship with her mother-in-law, Miriam, who's a survivor, and how she does this whole thing. So even though I know it intellectually, I forget sometimes that Jews who are born Jewish have a really complicated relationship with Judaism. You know, and you can forget that. I can forget that as a convert, because my relationship with Judaism was never tentative. You know, it was, yes, I had a few hard things, like I took on the whole package of mitzvahs, but I really didn't appreciate not singing in front of men. I loved to sing. I hated that one. So I just set it aside for the first couple of years. Now I buy into it, but I didn't like it. I still don't like it, but now I get it, so I don't do it. But but I did. But it wasn't like this pull. Like she had, like just to see in her mind, she wants to light candles. Should she light them on time or not on time? Should she make a bracha? Why light candles without making a bracha? But if you're making a bracha, it means you're making a bracha to somebody. But does she believe in anybody to make a bracha to? And like, you know, if she doesn't believe, so she should, what bracha is she saying? And yet, lighting candles, though, and why does she want to light candles? But she does want to light candles. And like that whole, like I never had a dialogue like that. Never. So, but I realized that a lot of Jews who are born Jewish have that really complicated relationship from all these generations of stuff that goes on with Jews inside and outside. And it started all the way back. So my husband and I were discussing Jewish history and, you know, how we should, somebody said something negative at the Shabbos table. I said, let's just focus on the positive. And he said, oh, right. You're going to teach Jewish history and focus only on the positive. So here's your class. We got the Torah, and here we are. How can you teach Jewish history without teaching the negative, right? It's just like, it's a lot of stuff in between that and this. So, anyway, so we have the Shomronim, we have the Samaritans there, we have the happy Jews in Babylon, we have the zealous and strong Jews who are coming back to the land of Israel, schlepping along a piece of the remnant to Israel, and now they have to make a new, they want to establish a second commonwealth. So that's what brings us up to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the great assembly. We have now a body, the Sanhedrin, 70, the legislative body of the Jews, the sages of the Jewish people, who where one dies, another one replaces that one, so there's always 70, is now swelled to 120. In Hebrew, again, it's called the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. So our Knesset today, in the Third Commonwealth, and we don't know for sure this is the Third Commonwealth, but we sure hope so, right? This establishment of the State of Israel that we just had in 1948, when they established the Knesset, has 120 seats because of this legislative body. So it's the same word, Anshei Knesset HaGedolah.
I missed the jump from 70 to 120.
So the Sanhedrin is 70.
Oh, and the Knesset is 120.
And the Knesset is 120. So when they brought, when the Jews came back from Babylon, they saw they're bringing back some pretty weak troops. And so they need stronger leadership. And so they're going to swell that body of 70 into 120 to be able to include all the sages and remaining prophets of the generation
well,
into that body.
Was there also a Sanhedrin?
The Sanhedrin was part of that group.
I see.
So 70 of the 120 was the Sanhedrin, and the remaining were the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. The whole thing was called the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly. This particular group, though, that 120 number, just died from attrition. So as people died from the upper number, right, from the top 50, they just died. And then it was 119, and then it was 118, and then, you know, down until the 70 when the 70 was the number. But the initial swelling of the number till 120 was just temporary for this time, and as those people died out, they were done with that number. So there are some prophets who were part of that, Haggai, Malachi, and Zechariah. You don't have to remember those right now. But what's important to understand is that in the reestablishment of the Second Temple, some serious prayers went into effect. So what happened? The First Temple was destroyed because of foreign worship. What we call idol worship, it's a bad translation. It's an idiomatic translation of the Hebrew words avodah zarah, avodah zarah, avodah zarah, foreign worship. We call it idol worship, but if we say idol worship, we're thinking of little Buddhas or little statues of Mary and bowing down to them, right? That's not what it is. It's foreign worship. Any kind of worship that's not Jewish. Any kind of worship that's not Jewish is considered foreign worship, including idol worship, and I don't think anybody, maybe some people, but in general, idol worship is not our childish notion of bowing down to a statue or thinking that that statue made you. You know, I mean, some of the Psalms say, you know, it has a mouth and it doesn't speak. It has ears and it doesn't hear. It has eyes and it doesn't see. Obviously, nobody who makes an idol or whittles it or is a potter or whatever it is, carves it out of jade, nobody thinks that thing made them. Nobody thinks that's their creator. So I actually had an experience with somebody that I'm close to in my non-Jewish family who sets up the sacred space designer. All right, so it's set up altars for people. So as this person is putting Kuan Yin and Buddha and Jesus and candles and flowers and photographs, you know, on an altar, and I'm like, a Kuan Yin, really? I mean, besides the other ones, Kuan Yin, Chinese goddess of compassion. I said, you know, that's really, I'm thinking as the Jew that's supposed to educate the Gentiles here, at least about this mitzvah, that's usher, even for non-Jews. You're not allowed to do idol worship. It's not idol worship, she's telling me. I don't believe Kuan Yin is compassion. When I see Kuan Yin, she's telling me, it evokes in me feelings of compassion. It helps draw compassion out of me. So I said, that's exactly it. An intermediary that helps you focus on a concept, that's the Jewish idea of idol worship. That's what's tricky about being a Jew and praying as a Jew, is no images of God allowed. Not allowed to think an image. You can't even think throne with old man and beard. No, we don't think these things, right? No thoughts at all, no pictures. Certainly we don't manifest a picture. Not allowed to draw one or carve one or paint one or anything like that. But we don't even conjure a picture. No pictures allowed. So that's very tricky in being a Jew to have no pictures. And the Jews regularly slipped into it. Even in groups, regularly slipped into some type of picture, because it's very hard to not have a picture when you're thinking about God. And yet, a picture is a limitation, and so we don't want to limit our concepts of God. We want to realize that we don't have that. There aren't limits, so any picture limits. So we have to be very careful with that. But anyway, that is why the First Temple was destroyed, is because of Jewish foreign worship. We integrated incorrect practices. So the temple's destroyed. Right? So now, I mean, you imagine, here you have the temple. You've got a king of Israel. You've got the Jews strong in the land, strong economics. We have our own government. We have manifest miracles in the First Temple that didn't exist in the Second Temple, but manifest miracles. And yet the Jews are what? It's unbelievable. Jews are unbelievable in their ability to go astray. We're so good at it, right? As soon as you command us, right away, we got that verse saying, do something else, do something else, do something else. Right? And we do. We listen to that voice regularly. So the Jews are busy listening.
Something about the images, like Isaiah and Ezekiel had visions of the throne. They're like out of space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But not of God.
There were godly visions.
Godly visions, but not of God. Vision of throne.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. There are visions, but you're not supposed to imagine God.
Okay.
Because you can't, right?
My daughter did ask me at the Shabbos table what I thought God looked like.
Right.
Right. This last weekend.
Right.
It was interesting, you know.
So I'll tell you something fabulous that Scott Alpert did at this very table. I believe it was right here. Robert Wasserman had a board meeting, and he passed out pieces of paper to everybody. And he said, I'd like everybody to draw what God looks like. Show me what God looks like. Pass out the paper. All right, so everybody's like, oh, it's Rabbi Wasserman, so they know it's a trick question, right? They're trying to figure out, okay, what does God look like? Well, some people are starting to think. And Scott Alpert, who doesn't wear glasses, I don't think, or didn't at the time, he takes his piece of paper and he goes like this. So that was created in the image of God. That must be what God looks like. So what does God look like? God doesn't look, right? But, and yet we were created in the image of God. Also, different class, we could discuss it, but not right now. Mm-hmm. So we have, yeah.
Why is it so important to go back and rebuild the temple?
Good question. Mm-hmm. It's such an important one, too. It deserves a very long answer to really understand the importance of the temple and what it is. So I can't give you a long answer. I can give you a short answer and just keep it as a question, but just to give you an idea, because it's not about the building. We could care less about buildings. Buildings come, buildings go, and yet the Jewish desire is always rebuild the temple, rebuild the temple. What is that about? The temple in Kabbalistic literature is referred to as the bedroom of the world. What is the bedroom? Right? The marital bedroom is the place of ultimate connection between husband and wife. Right, where the ultimate intimacy takes place. And that's what the temple is about, is between the ultimate intimacy between God and the Jewish people, his wife. So all humanity is considered feminine in this, and God masculine. Not that God has a gender at all, but in terms of this, in the giving nature of masculinity, which is also a Kabbalistic concept, that the masculine energy gives, the feminine energy receives and transforms. So in this case, then God is the giver, and human beings receive and transform. Right? So God gives aluminum, we make airplanes. Right? So God did mean for us to fly without giving us wings, because he gave us intelligence and aluminum, and we could figure out computers. So, but the temple is that place of ultimate connection, the place where the energy of God is channeled into the world. So God does exist everywhere and is accessible everywhere, except for when we create mini vacuums where we drive God's presence from that place. That's called a Chilul Hashem, or a desecration of God's name, when we behave in a way that's so ugly or antithetical to God's plan that we chase God out of that space temporarily. But otherwise, God exists everywhere. And still, there is this whole physical existence that we're in right now. God is only spiritual, not physical. And our eternal souls are only spiritual, not physical. But we're placed, our spiritual souls are placed in this physical body, in this physical arena, in order to accomplish something. And so there has to be ways to accomplish. So what we're accomplishing is connection with God, ultimate, forever, eternal relationship with God. And the way that we create relationship is by doing stuff. Right? So your relationship with your spouse is very different right when you get married, then it is 10 years later, then it is 20 years later, then it is 60 years later. And even if you're a sophisticated, intelligent, caring, loving person, if you get married for the first time at 60, there's no comparison between your relationship as loving 60-year-olds who have been married for a month than a relationship of loving 60-year-olds who have been married for 40 years. Right? Just because you've gone through all those experiences, you've created something that's so much deeper that you don't have access to without doing, right? It's only through behavior that you create relationship. So all that behavior and all that history is what creates relationship. So we're given an opportunity to come into this world to behave, however we're supposed to behave, in order to create a relationship with God. So that when we exit this world, we have a relationship. So the center of all of that is the land of Israel, the Temple Mount. This temple, the Holy of Holies, right, is considered the most intensely holy space on the planet, the physical space. So we are in a physical existence. And so spiritual things manifest through physical channels. So the physical channel that helps manifest the presence of God is the temple. Now, that being said, when we were first commanded to build the temple, the actual verse in the Bible says, build for me a mikdash, and I will dwell among you. Not I will dwell in it. It's not build for me a temple, and I'll live in that place, the house of God. God doesn't have a house, right? Build for me the temple, and I'll dwell among you. So what really God is saying is, I'm going to give you a whole set of things to do, to behave in. And when you do that, you create a space inside you that I can live in.
So why aren't we building another one in Israel? If the space is really not so relevant,
it is relevant.
Does it have to be on the space where the Holy of Holies is?
Yeah, that's the spot.
Why are they not building it?
Well, we got the Dome of the Rock there right now. Kind of inconvenient.
That's true.
Muslims would not be so happy. Right.
So it has to be there or nowhere else.
That's the spot.
There's no leeway. It physically has to be. If the statement is, build a space and I will dwell among you, why can't it be a mile down the road?
Okay, so we can build the space for Hashem to dwell among in us right now, which is what our job is in the way that we relate to ourself, others, community, God. All of that is about building that space within us. And that's what our whole life is about, is building the space inside us. And that's why we Jews are still here today. Because while we are space dependent, we're not space dependent. We're Torah dependent. If we were space dependent and temple dependent, we wouldn't exist anymore. We couldn't possibly exist 2,000 years in exile without a land that we share, without a language that we share, without a culture that we share, without a government that rules over all of us. We don't have any of that. We're the only people on the planet that's lived this long without any central anything. What's central is the Torah. So as long as Jews have their 2 feet planted strongly in the Torah, or even a pinky, you know, when the Torah goes up and we go like that and kiss it, as long as we're even connected that far, we're still connected. The Torah is what keeps us Jewish. Leave the Torah behind, and you leave Judaism behind. It may take a generation or two or three, but if you don't reconnect, you're out. There is one stream of Jewish history, and it flows, and it changes, and it's dynamic. It's not a straight stream from Sinai to here. It's a flowing stream with a lot of branches that flowed, and it seems like some flowed in and some flowed out, but we do see in hindsight, and we can't always tell right now, but in hindsight, we can see who is kosher and who wasn't, who's Jewish and who isn't. You can tell. Whoever sticks around, they're the Jews. The Frankists, not Jewish. The Shomronim, not Jewish. The Christians, not Jewish. You can tell it now. Now we have questions. Who's Jewish today? Who are the right philosophies of today? We're not going to really know for sure for 100 or 200 years. We can, though, today we can make guesses based on our history. So based on that flow of history, we see whoever has been planted in Torah is still Jewish today. Whoever has taken steps outside of Torah is not. So we could guess that basic trend. And then within also, there's all kinds of questions even within those people who are connected to Torah. What does that mean? So, and there's lots of conversation about that. Who's in charge and who's not? Every generation has its own challenge. And that's actually the message, because I was thinking, you know, I realized inside myself 1 year when I taught Milton and hated it, did not get along with the whole Milton teaching. For me, wasn't good because it was about literacy, not about inspiration. I like to inspire when I teach. That was my own reflection on self, right? I'm not teaching for literacy. So while I want to give literacy, and I think it's very important to understand history because once you understand history, you can be inspired by it, I still want to inspire. So the message for today is, every generation has its own challenge, and we have our own unique challenge. So that's hopefully the take-home message, but getting back to the challenge of the generation of the men of the Great Assembly, let's look back at that. So they had a particular challenge. The challenge of the first temple time was, how do you overcome idol worship? How do you get the Jews out of this big Yetzer Hara, this big trend, the pull? They're so spiritual, but the spirituality draws them to all kinds of trace spiritualities. How do you clean that up? And that was a question that the sages dealt with in Babylon as they reflected on what the disaster was of the destruction of the first temple. Not just the destruction of the first temple, but the destruction of the whole Jewish commonwealth. Everything that kept the Jews together was destroyed. And this is the first time they go into exile as a post national nation in a way, right? They go as a group without a government, without central authority, with infrastructure, but they're not in charge. They're only in charge internally, not externally, of themselves. So to the degree that people adhere to Torah law, they're in charge. To the degree that anybody will show up at a Beit Din, if you are summoned to a Beit Din today, if you go, then the Beit Din's law will apply to you. And in this country, it's binding arbitration. If you choose not to go because you don't feel like it, so then you can be called to an American court, and that will be binding upon you. But if you choose to answer to Torah call, then you'll be bound by Torah law, right? So only those who chose into it were bound by it and could participate in it. So anyway, you have this, so that as the sages are reflecting on what went wrong, why did the first Commonwealth, why was it destroyed and how will they change it, they realize there's this huge Yetzer Hara, huge internal drive towards all kinds of spirituality. And so they prayed to God before the establishment of the Second Commonwealth. They said, please, God, take that drive away from us. We can't handle it. As a group, we fell. We were destroyed. We destroyed ourselves because of this urge. And we feel like we can't build. We can't even think of building, establishing a Second Commonwealth with that drive still in us. We're weak now, weaker than we were then, and we still have that drive. How could we possibly establish a Second Commonwealth with that? Please take it away. So God responded and said, okay, I'll do it. I'll take it away. But, there's always a but, right? But I have to make it fair, right? If I want it to be fair that the struggle inside you should be balanced. So if I'm taking away the negative urge towards foreign spirituality, I have to take away something positive too. The positive thing that I'm going to take away, does anybody know? 10 points for this one. Prophecy.
What?
Prophecy. I will take away prophecy from the Jews. So prophecy only existed until the establishment of the Second Temple. So in this Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, in this Men of the Great Assembly, the last remaining prophets were apart, but no new prophets were born. No new prophets were trained, because it's like Olympics. You're both innately capable and trained into it. You could be innately capable of being an Olympic star and not train, and you'll never make it. Or you could train like an Olympic star and not have the innate capability, and you'll never make it, right? You have to have both, an innate capability and the intense training. That's what prophecy is, innate capability and intense training. Of incorrect spirituality, desire for too much spirituality, desire for the untamed desire for spirituality, the undirected desire for spirituality. We daven for it to go away because we already saw the destructive capability of it. I'm sure that during that temple time, there were prayers, excuse me, to direct it properly. Didn't work. So that was basically the deal that was struck in a way. Yes, I'll take away that destructive urge for idol worship, for foreign worship, and I will take away prophecy. So what does that mean? This is a very important point to understand. And this is where we get back to the Samaritans. And there's way too much stuff for me to tell you in the next 10 minutes. Okay, but this is an important concept to understand. The men of the Great Assembly, then, their function as a legislative and executive body was to effect the transition in the Jewish stream between prophetic Judaism and rabbinic Judaism. Rabbinic. This was the switch. We had the time of the prophets, people who had a direct connection to God and were able to express God's will to us in ways that we can understand it. Right? Even our healers were prophets. Rather than go to a doctor at the time, we'd go to a prophet who would say, oh, your problem is you have shotness in your closet. You're wearing linen and wool mixed together. That's why you have a sore throat. Go check your garments for shotness and it'll go away. Right? Our physical ailments were manifestations of spiritual maladies. And the prophets could see it and tell us. Today we still have a concept, but it's not as closely connected because we don't have prophecy. So even though we are supposed to use our physical ailments to look and see what might be physically ailing us, there's not that direct connection. So we don't have to say specifically, you know, because I have this, it must mean I did that, Right? That's not the connection, but it was then. So we have prophetic Judaism, and then we have a flip into rabbinic Judaism, the Judaism that we live in today. Judaism that's led by rabbis, not by prophets. Now, the Christians had a very hard time with that. Didn't appreciate that at all, because they're all about not being of the law, and yes, being of faith. Rabbis dictate law. They're not about faith. They are about faith, too, but we're not a faith religion. Christianity was monotheism light, right? There was no other monotheism at the time. But for those pagans, because they've been so busy as conquering nations, conquer, absorb, conquer, absorb, conquer, absorb, right? And they have this huge pagan mishmash now all over the place. People of intelligence said, this is stupid. 9,700 gods and four holidays a day? You know, like, we can't keep track of this and it doesn't make sense. We need monotheism. That makes sense. But the only monotheism there is Judaism, and that's way too hard, not interested. All those mitzvahs plus circumcision, forget about it. So arose monotheism light in the form of Christianity. Now, the Christians at first were a Jewish sect, but they opposed rabbinic rule. Hence, the rise of the Good Samaritan. Because what the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah did, the Sanhedrin, put down the Samaritans. They came in as a legislative body and said, you guys are not Jewish. But there's a war back and forth. Yes, we are. No, you're not. Yes, we are. No, you're not. So the Samaritans were not happy with the Jews. So in the New Testament, when there's a story of the Good Samaritan, that's a shtuch at the rabbis in rabbinic Judaism. Saying, ah, see this Samaritan? He's good. Samaritans are good. Not like you Jews think, bad. We Christians think good. And so we have the story of the Good Samaritan. But that's all about the transition into rabbinic Judaism and rabbinic-run Judaism, which is what was happening here at this switch between the end of the Babylonian exile and the beginning of the establishment of the Second Commonwealth.
But the Good Samaritans, is, from what you say, were more fundamentalist, more zealot. In their belief and believing all the precepts of the religion.
Yes.
Than the rabbinic.
Correct. That's correct. Doesn't matter, though, but it, so they were. They did have more of a, they were more zealot. They did base their observance more on the written Torah than on the oral Torah. Oral Torah being very much interpreted through the rabbinic tradition.
Was that when the Masorah, when the Masoretic Bible...
The Masoretic text.
Masoretic text started.
I think the Masoretic text is a little bit later. I'm pretty sure that that has to do with the vowelization, if I'm not positive, that happened later. Anyway, I have 5 more minutes. I see people are ready to go, but let me quick get to my blue sheet here. Okay, end of Babylonian exile. Ezra and Nehemiah established this men of the Great Assembly, so they are the key prophets that come back. They're the ones who establish it. Major accomplishments? We didn't get to any of this. Quick. Okay. So here are the major accomplishments of the men of the Great Assembly. They canonized and sealed the Bible. What does that mean? There are lots of different writings floating around at the time. They're the ones who decided what are the 24 books that we call the Tanakh. The Torah, 5 books. The Nevi'im, the prophets, early prophets and later prophets. And then the writings. I have them written down for you, but there's not enough time to tell you them. So you can look them up yourself. However, I will tell you that the way they figured it out is by deciding which were written with Ruach HaKodesh, Holy Spirit, divine inspiration, and which were not. If it wasn't written with divine inspiration, if it wasn't written with a spirit of prophecy, it doesn't qualify for Holy Scripture. And so they decided, they discerned which books are written with Holy Spirit, with divine inspiration, and which weren't, and then they sealed it. Once it was sealed, it was done. Of course, it had to be sealed then, because that's when prophecy ended. So there could be no more books written with divine inspiration. So, for instance, the next major book that was written, which we do excellent, the Book of the Maccabees, which is an accurate, mostly, an accurate historical account of what happened, this Book of the Maccabees, it was the product of human genius, not the product of divine inspiration. And this is a key point for us to remember. What's written in the Tanakh, divine inspiration, outside of that, not divine inspiration. Key point for the Jews, because of course we draw our line earlier, but that excludes New Testament, excludes Quran, which isn't even actually an additional testament, unlike the Book of Mormon, which is an additional testament to the New Testament. The Quran is, in their mind, the Muslims' mind is, the Jews got the Torah from God, forgot the Torah from God, got it re-revealed to us through Muhammad. So their Quran is not in addition, but a replacement. They think it's the original, just re-revealed. So that's different than the Christian addition to ours. Anyway, so they canonized and sealed. And anything else is called the Apocrypha, something that's written outside. There is a Jewish Apocrypha and a Christian Apocrypha. Two different things, different stuff in it. But just so you know, just because somebody says Apocrypha doesn't mean it's Jewish or not. I still have a few more minutes. Stay put. They established the order of prayer. What did people do when they weren't going to the temple? Here you have the temple, which is the central place of Jewish worship. But for non-temple days, what did they do? There's quite a bit of questions of what people did on non-temple days during the first temple period. It did seem that there was some communal service, and there certainly was the communal saying of the Shema. But what was their prayer like? During this 70-year period of exile, there was established an order of prayer that happened in Babylon and then came back and then proceeded concurrently with temple service after the rebuilding of the Second Temple. But the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, the men of the Great Assembly, established and wrote the Siddur that we have today. So that was an important accomplishment. So they took that order of prayer, filled it out, fleshed it out, and they wrote the Shemona Esrei, the 18 blessings, which we know has actually 19 blessings in it. They wrote 18 at the time, at the rebuilding of the Second Temple. It wasn't until almost the end of the Second Temple, with the rise of Christianity, that the 19th blessing was added, a 19th blessing against cults and separating groups from Judaism to fell them spiritually. So that's the 19th one. Then they also established an educational system in Judaism. Actually, Torah was passed father to son, mother to daughter, until this weak group comes back from Babylon, and we see that the parent-child transmission system is not working so well. In fact, it's the father-son transmission system that's not working, and so a school system for boys is established at the time. It's important to remember that Fiddler on the Roof and Tevye notwithstanding, girls were educated equally. Not the same material, but the same value that a girl needs to be educated. That did fall into misunderstanding in Russia in later times. Girls were educated but continued in the mother-daughter education, not in a formal school system, basically up until about 100 years ago. About 200 years ago is when the system broke down for mothers-to-daughter transmission. It was broken for about 100 years, and then the Beis Yaakov school system was established by Sarah Schneer, who said girls have to be educated in schools. Initially, there was opposition to that. Girls shouldn't be educated in schools. It wasn't what Tevye said, girls don't get educated. It's that girls are supposed to be educated at home. Sarah Schneer said, no, girls have to be educated in schools because that system has broken, and now we have a girls' education system too. But they established the educational system. And they established a Jewish calendar. I can't explain it. It's too long, but you should know. Jewish calendar, very interesting. I have lots of notes about it. Sorry. And then one more important thing to get here. Two more things. Okay. So they dealt with the Shomronim. They quelled them, political ramifications. They dealt with the Shomronim, quelled the Shomronim. The legislative style was that rather than have a king, they have 120 people running the country, which means it doesn't run as well. I mean, look at Israel today, 120 people running the country. Right. So, and what that did, though, was shift the position of the Kohen Gadol. If you don't have a king, then the Kohen Gadol was not subservient to the king. So in the first temple times, you had a king and a Kohen Gadol. King ran everything. Kohen Gadol was a religious functionary. But in the second temple, because there wasn't a king, the personage of the Kohen Gadol rose into very high esteem. And he became politically powerful and rabbinically powerful and religiously powerful. He became very powerful.
Was he elected?
He was not elected. He had to be from the Kohanic class. He was appointed.
Like the Pope, huh?
Sort of. I don't know exactly. I can't say that's exactly correct. But he had to be from a certain line, from the Kohanic family. But what this did do that's important to remember for future history, which you'll learn, is that this did lay the foundation for corruption in the priestly class. Because this shift to no king, so taking the power out of the kingship, allowed some power to be diverted to the Kohen Gadol, and power corrupts. So the Kohanic class became corrupted a little bit later on with the death of Shimon HaTzadik, who was the final Kohen, the final righteous person from this collective body, Simon the Righteous, Shimon HaTzadik. He lived for a long time, about 120 years. He actually met Alexander the Great. So he passed off kind of, there is a story in the Talmud about their encounter, which is an interesting story. But so he's the last surviving member of this 120-person body, Shimon HaTzadik. When he dies,
pardon? Did he run it by himself?
He didn't run it by himself, but he was the Kohen Gadol and the sage and very powerful at the time. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who encountered Alexander the Great and stopped the slaughter of the Jews by Alexander the Great, but instead made it a peaceful handoff. But, so he handed off peacefully, but he also laid the foundation, or this whole group laid the foundation for the later corruption of the Kohanim, which happens after the story of Hanukkah. But this is where that flip happens. So in every generation, there's our own challenges. Each generation has its own challenge. So the First Temple Time challenge was, how do you set up a Jewish commonwealth and deal with this Yetzer Hara? Second commonwealth challenge was, in the absence of prophecy, how do you continue as a Jewish people? We have challenges for every generation. We have our own challenge. How will we deal with our challenges? I'm not going to enumerate them all now, but we have our own unique challenges. How do we, in wealth and comfort, and I'm not saying we're all wealthy, but all our bellies are full and all our leaks, our roofs aren't leaking, you know, we all have clothes in our closet. How do we, from this place of wealth and comfort, political comfort too, how do we coalesce as a Jewish nation and keep our mission intact, especially in this era of openness and ideas, and how do we stay focused in a way that other generations didn't have this challenge? It's our unique challenge. How do we deal with this? And so every generation, it's not that we have to stay the same in this stream of Jewish continuity. The reason why it's so different is not that we have to be a straight, the same, we're the same now as we were then. It's that we have to manifest the Jewish mission with our own personal set of challenges in every generation. And so Judaism has to always respond to this generation's challenges with the same mission, but different tactics. So I'll leave you with that to think about. How do we create the newness in this generation to handle our challenges?
Wow.